loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we have our weekly segment called The Week in Review. We have this segment every Friday. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs. This week, we talk about the government shutdown, which is now tied for the longest in U.S. history, the troop withdrawal from Syria, and the New York Times Manafort story retraction this week.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the U.S. military today said the troop withdrawal from Syria has already begun, but refused to give a timetable for the pullout. This move comes despite National Security Advisor Bolton's announcement of a series of difficult-to-meet conditions that would need to be met before the withdrawal would happen. Next, today is day 21 of the government shutdown, tied for the longest in history. Approximately 800,000 federal workers continue to be affected by the shutdown, as well as people on Native reservations, national parks, farmers, and many others. President Trump went to the border yesterday, and there have been increasing signs that he may issue a national emergency to fund the wall. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered a high-profile address in Cairo yesterday, doubling down on the Trump administration's hostile posture towards Iran and pushing the regime change agenda. Pompeo purposefully chose to give his speech in the same location as former President Obama's landmark 2009 address. And then, Polish authorities arrested a Huawei sales executive, the second Huawei executive arrested in recent months. Meanwhile, trade talks between the U.S. and China have continued all week, which is being interpreted as a positive sign by financial markets. Will there be resolution from the recent trade war? And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and the just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, Congolese opposition candidate Martin Fayulu filed a challenge in court today disputing the official results of the election. Félix Tshisekedi, also an opposition candidate, was declared the winner. However, Fayulu has claimed that Tshisekedi's victory was a result of a fraudulent deal made with outgoing President Joseph Kabila. The Trump administration announced today that Charles Kupperman will become the Deputy National Security Advisor. Kupperman held a number of positions during the Reagan administration, and he is also a former executive at major war contractors Boeing and Lockheed Martin. Ricardo Rossello, governor of Puerto Rico, reacted today to reports that the Trump administration is considering diverting money from hurricane relief efforts on the island to pay for a border wall along the border with Mexico. Rossello said, quote, "No wall should be funded on the pain and suffering of U.S. citizens who have endured tragedy and loss through a national disaster," unquote. Puerto Rico is still struggling to recover from the devastating hurricanes Irma and Maria that hit in 2017, a situation made worse by the island's status as a colony of the United States. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the United States will host an international conference February 13th and 14th to discuss how to ramp up the pressure on Iran. After withdrawing from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal, last year, the Trump administration has imposed new sanctions and sought to foment regime change in the country. The conference will be held in Poland. Those are today's headlines, and you are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review. We take a look at the big issues of the week, including politics, policy, and international affairs. We're speaking with Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're also joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and as I say, always my favorite cartoonist, and he should be your favorite cartoonist. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Ted, Walter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the government shutdown. Why not? It's 21 days now. It's a partial government shutdown, but nonetheless, 800,000 federal workers and many, many, many private contractors who are doing work for the federal government have not had a paycheck. Yesterday, they were supposed to get paid. They didn't get paid. A lot of people, Jackie, I saw a thing from the Coast Guard. It told federal workers, here's some good ideas if you're missing the paycheck. You know, in case you are, you can have a garage sale. You can get some of your belongings together and sell them. I thought that was extremely, you know, that was probably very, very helpful for the federal workers. They probably really appreciated that.
Insulting, maybe?
Let's have a garage sale.
Yeah, I mean, that guidance came from the Coast Guard to Coast Guard personnel. So, I mean, here we've been in this hyper-militaristic support our troops kind of environment in this country for God knows how long. And now we've got a branch of the military telling its personnel, well, we're not going to support you. You're just going to have to support yourself by selling all of your personal belongings to eat.
It's a national crisis, Ted, and maybe a national emergency, and that's why we can't pay you.
Well, maybe they need to do a GoFundMe. I suspect that whoever wrote that memo is definitely a deep state Democrat trying to make the Trump administration look bad. Because if he's not, he should be. He should get recruited. It's hilarious, the tone deafness. I'm a cartoonist, and I write scripts for comedy. And if I were, I couldn't come up with this because it would be too over the top. It would be, it's self-satire. It's awesome.
It reminded me of those, like, sample budgets that McDonald's distributed to its employees, where it was, like, you know, so ridiculously unreal. Like, spend $10 on the internet or something like that. You know, budget for rent, $300.
I saw a news story. There was a youngish by my standards, they had to make a home payment, as they do every month, on their mortgage. They're federal workers. They're living basically paycheck to paycheck. Federal workers are not rich. I mean, maybe some are affluent, some are middle class, but not the majority. And the story was, they contacted their lender, also known as a bank, and said, look, through no fault of our own, we actually can't make this month's mortgage payment. We don't want to go into default. And the lender, the bank, said, sorry, that's not our problem. Of course, it's not the problem. So here you have this toxic combination, Jackie, of the capitalist system, which is premised on money and maximizing profits first and foremost as the criteria for all things. Here you have federal workers who are, through no fault of their own, who go to work. Some of them are still working. Many of them still working without pay. They can't make their mortgage payment. And the fact of the matter is, there is no national emergency. There's no national crisis. Undocumented immigration is at the lowest it's been since 1972. That would be 46 years ago. The whole thing is made up.
Yeah, it's made up. And the national crisis that does exist is that American workers, American federal employees, civil servants and contractors, people who actually process your tax returns and process your Social Security and your disability payments and, you know, inspect your food, are not being paid. People who are TSA screeners are, and there were sick outs, hundreds of TSA
right.
screeners called out sick rather than work without pay over the past week in protest for this. We have federal workers who were actually protesting in certain states for their jobs, for their paychecks. That's the national crisis. The fact that so much of the country has no sympathy for these workers because the GOP has demonized the federal government as these, you know, self-interested fat cats, all of them, everyone who works in the federal government, to the point where Americans think that all federal workers are just, you know, lazy, filthy, rich people doing nothing at their computers, you know, living off the teat of the federal government largesse. And that is absolutely not true. Even managerial positions in most federal positions, unless you're talking about like top security clearance and beyond kind of positions, these are not people who are generally making more than maybe $90,000, maybe $120,000 a year. And depending on where they live, that's not a lot of money. It's not a lot of money here in D.C.
Yeah, I saw a statistic yesterday, Ted Rawl. I don't want to talk about this too much, but I just want to mention it, that somebody making $115,000 in San Francisco is considered low income because of housing costs. Ted, food safety inspections are slowing down or coming to a halt. Again, that's the nation's food supply, because food safety inspection offices are not getting funding. I mean, that could lead to a real national emergency.
Well, that's true. And, you know, let's not forget that the entire government isn't shut down. The U.S. is still, I'm sure, not saving money on drone bombings. Hellfire missiles are expensive. War is incredibly expensive, including debt service. It's over 50% of the federal budget. The military goes on, right? So what the message that we're being given by the powers that be, and this includes the Democrats because they haven't been exactly saying this as a talking point or anything, is that the priority of this system is to continue to kill brown people overseas. And, you know, if a little E. coli gets into the meat or into the romaine, so be it. Who cares? So it's not about people. It's about profits and nothing's changing. Of course, there was a great article, I think worth mentioning, in the New York Times a couple days ago, pointing out that the government shutdown actually ends up costing the government more money than it saves from because they're not paying people to sit home. Right now, people are sitting home getting paid, and then their work is piling up, and then they're going to have to ramp up, and they're going to have to pay overtime and pay temporary staffers to do all the backed-up work when they get back to work. And not to mention the parks aren't collecting admissions fees. A lot of parks are actually revenue positive. A lot of government activities are actually revenue positive. So not only are we grossly inconveniencing the American public and people who need those offices opened and the federal workers themselves, and of course the contractors who will get hit hardest because they're never going to be paid for the missed time. It's on top of all that, we've got this this situation where the government's actually going to end up losing money. So in the end, we'll all pay higher taxes. It's just a mess wrapped in a mess.
Walter Smolarek. 114,000 kids in New York City public schools are homeless today, because that's the number every day. That's one out of every 10 of New York City kids in public schools. Many of their parents are working families, you know, working parents. That's a crisis. That's a huge crisis. When you think about how the Democrats are handling this, it seems to me Trump is falsely declaring this national emergency, national crisis. He flies down to the border. All the border towns, by the way, have less crime than the rest of the United States. It's disrupting border towns. Building a wall will actually disrupt beautiful parts of the country because it's going to have this great big wall instead of these beautiful natural geological scenery. Here we have a situation where the Democrats could be making the point, this is bogus, and let's talk about the real crisis in America, that the number of homeless kids in New York City is growing every day, 1 out of 10. But instead, they appear on TV, Schumer and Pelosi, looking truly like stuffed animals after Trump's speech. And they only talk about, oh, let's get the government back going, we can negotiate. In other words, they're not going at Trump on the issues that would actually impact the larger non-federal workforce part of the population that is reeling in crisis. I mean, they could be taking advantage of this moment to say, no, this is false, but there is a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, considering the magnitude of hardship and suffering that this is causing, you know, the federal workers, people who rely on government services, businesses who rely on those people to patronize them. I mean, you know, it's really remarkable that Donald Trump's approval ratings are not going down, and they're not. You know, I've been following some of the daily tracking polls. He's doing, you know, basically okay. And I think that's because of, you know, just how pathetic the opposition to his policies and this particular policy or tactic of a government shutdown really is, because like the only person who's talking about like an issue of political principle is Donald Trump, even though it's a completely incorrect and bad political principle of, you know, scapegoating immigrants for like all of the problems in the United States. And the Democrats don't actually take that. In fact, they kind of go out of their way to sort of half agree with Trump, because they'll say, oh, no, you know, we're for border security, right? We are not for, you know, undocumented immigrants coming in. But, you know, the reality of the situation, the reality of why there's all those different, you know, crises that Brian laid out facing poor and working people and middle class people, too, is that, you know, basically all of the money is concentrated in the hands of a tiny handful of rich people on Wall Street. And the Democrats are never going to point that out, because they get, you know, a lot of their money from those people. They go to the country club with them. They go to cocktail parties together. They're part of the same club. And so, you know, they can never actually provide a convincing, persuasive answer to people about, you know, why their lives have been getting worse for the past, you know, decades or generations. And Trump, you know, while he's providing a false answer, is at least addressing it.
Important point, I think. And I want to talk about why Trump's approval ratings are strong, or as strong as they've been. Here's a New York Times article. Farm country stood by Trump, but the shutdown is pushing it to a breaking point. In Georgia, I'm reading from the Times, in Georgia, a pecan farmer lost out on his chance to buy his first orchard. The local farm service agency office that would have processed his loan application was shut down. In Wisconsin's Dairy Country, a 55-year-old woman sat inside her new dream home worried she would not be able to pay her mortgage. Her loan had come from the Agriculture Department program for low-income residents in rural areas, but all of the account information she needed to make her first payment was locked away in an empty government office. And in upstate New York, Pam Moore was feeding hay to her black and white cows at a small dairy that tottered on the brink of ruin. She and her husband had run up a $350,000 debt to keep the dairy running after 31 of their cows died of pneumonia. And their last lifeline was an emergency federal farm loan, but the money has been derailed by the government shutdown. Okay, when you know these things, you would think Trump's traditional base is being actually harmed now by the policies of Trump creating this bogus crisis. But when you look at the poll numbers and when you look at these areas, it seems to me that a lot of this same part of the population is staying with Trump because the Democrats' agitation, the Democrats' political presentation is just not winning at all.
You're right. They're not speaking to the reality of the situation of people, like you said, who are suffering all the time. But they're also not addressing people like the New York Times point out in this article who have such a negative view of government as like a GOP policy, but they're also the same people who rely on government for their livelihoods. And it's such an easy argument for the Democrats to make that, you know, as much as you want Trump to shut down the government and keep the government shut down to hurt those people over there who you think are taking advantage of the government, please remember that it's the same government that provides you the benefits that you need for your livelihood, for your FHA loan, for your farm loan, for your, you know, for all these things that these farmers rely on for their livelihoods. How is that not the same government that they're cheering is being shut down because they think, and I read this, I can't remember what publication it was, a woman said that she was upset. She was a Trump supporter. She was angry that the government was shut down, not because she didn't want it to be shut down, but because the government shutdown was now hurting people that it wasn't supposed to hurt. So, I mean, that's the attitude that exists in Trump country, that, you know, the government shutdown is good because it hurts who they believe are bad people who deserve to be hurt. And they're so short-sighted in their understanding of the role of government in everyone's lives that they forget that, oh, wait, this is the same government that puts bread on your table, too.
We're talking with Jacqueline Lookman from Lookman Nation. We're also talking with award-winning editorial cartoonist Ted Rawl. And we're talking with Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. Ted Rawl, let's talk about whether or not this crisis comes to an end vis-a-vis Donald Trump declaring a national emergency and taking money from other parts of the budget to begin the building of the wall, the 5.6 or 5.3 billion. It seems to me that while that's, again, sort of an unconstitutional piece of maneuver because Congress controls the purse, if the president doesn't like what Congress is doing in terms of authorizing and appropriating funds, declaring a false, bogus national security to get around Congress, it would seem on its face would be unconstitutional to me, especially when it's, you know, on its face, not a national crisis. Nonetheless, if Trump declares a national emergency and starts funding the wall, then the Democrats can say, okay, now we can, you know, reopen the government. Trump will sign the law to reopen the government. He doesn't have to veto it because he's getting funds elsewhere. The government does reopen. Both sides claim victory. Trump can go into the 2020 election saying, I fought hard. I did whatever I had to do, and I did whatever I needed to do in order to fulfill my campaign promise.
I agree with your analysis. I don't think there's really any downside for Trump declaring a national emergency to get his wall funding. It'll be tied up, that order will be tied up in court, but he'll get credit from his base for having pushed hard to fulfill a much-repeated, high-profile campaign promise. he's not going to lose anyone on the left anyway. Not, it does let the Democrats off the hook to the extent that they're concerned about any blowback on the shutdown. So if I were Trump, I would absolutely do this. I think he's probably already decided to do it. He may not, but I'm going to give it 75% chance he's going to do this within the next week or two. I think he has a really great sense of drama from his experience on television, and he knows that the buildup to the announcement is part of what's going to add to his mystique and his power with his base, and they're going to love it. So there's just really no reason not to. I mean, in terms of the unconstitutionality issue, really, does he care? I mean, he can always say, look, who knows if it's unconstitutional? Maybe it's unconstitutional, maybe it's not, as Trump would say. We'll let the courts figure it out, and the courts will figure it out, and they're going to determine that it is unconstitutional. But on the other hand, they may not. The United States, the president often has the ability to declare areas where, say, a tornado or a hurricane has hit as a national disaster area, and that releases funding right away. The president has lots of tricks at his, up his sleeve that he can pull money out of a hat. So I think he'll do it. I think he'd be kind of stupid not to.
Let's do a final comments from the two of you, Jackie and Walter, following up on Ted's comments. How does this end? Does this end sometime in the next day or two with a national emergency?
Yes, I think maybe not the next day or two, but I think sometime next week, I think Trump is going to declare this national emergency because I think, like Ted said, but what does he have to lose? Absolutely nothing. It's another one of those media marketing kind of moves that he's used to doing and getting the traction from it, whether it makes sense or whether it's the right thing to do or not.
Yeah, it makes sense to me, too. I think he'll declare a national emergency. And yeah, I mean, it might even be over this weekend. I mean, I'm not sure what other maneuvers he has to pull. And, you know, what are the real consequences for him? Well, he'll have to go to court, right? But I mean, he's already embroiled. His administration is already embroiled in tons and tons of legal challenges to different policies. And it's actually kind of, in terms of political optics, I think he's fine with that narrative, even if the courts strike down the national emergency, which I think, you know, they might not for sure. You know, the judicial system has become very, very right wing in the United States. But, you know, like that, the political optics of like, oh, I'm trying to do things, but these obstructionist liberal judges are trying to stop me. I think that's also like a politically winning thing that he wouldn't mind at all.
In our last 2 minutes before we go to break, I want to introduce another subject, and it's not about domestic policy. It's about foreign policy. James Mattis resigned a couple weeks ago the day after Trump announced that the U.S. was going to withdraw all of its troops from Syria and half of the troops from Afghanistan. He resigned. It became a big deal. Liberals and progressives who in the past were opposed to James Mad Dog Mattis were suddenly loving him because he was resigning in opposition to Trump's policy. What we're looking at right now is an uncertainty, a profound uncertainty over whether the U.S. actually is going to follow the dictates of the commander-in-chief and leave Syria, because John Bolton is going around everywhere in the Middle East and in Turkey sort of making it clear that the U.S. a plan to withdraw from Syria may not be real, putting into place so many obstacles that it's just another smoke and mirrors. And in some ways, it seems like Trump is going along with it. And yet I'm looking at the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and the journal says, no, the U.S. is actually, the Pentagon is right now planning to withdraw troops from Syria. We're going to discuss this more in length later in our program, but I want to get each of you to make a quick comment about that. Jackie, let's get your response, and then we're going to go to a break and come back.
Yeah, this whole situation is made even more murky because of the position of Turkey and their, rightfully so, their anger at being told by the United States what they have to do in regard to the Kurdish forces. There's that. Then there is Erdogan basically going on television, on Turkish television, telling Bolton or telling the world that, you know, Bolton does not know what he's talking about. So there's that sticking point. I don't think the United States leaves Syria. I don't think the ground troops leave anytime soon. I know that, you know, they've announced the January 11th, which is today, beginning of troop drawdown. But I don't buy it. I think the situation is too murky. It's too volatile. But regardless of whether troops stay or leave, we know that we will continue to bomb and provide that kind of support in Syria.
30 seconds to a break. Ted Rall, what's your view?
Jacqueline's right. The bombing continues. Bombing's cheap and easy. Ground troops are expensive and hard politically. Ground troops, I mean, the 2000 will come home. But let's not forget the Afghanistan experience under Obama. You can take troops out and put them right back in.
Indeed. Okay, we're going to go to a break. We're going to come back after the break to talk about some of the other big stories of this week. We're talking with Jacqueline Lookman, Ted Rall, and Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. This week we talk, as we do every Friday, about the big issues of the week in this segment called The Week in Review. We talk about politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She joins us here in the studio. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. That's RALL.com. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Walter, we have a lot more to cover in this second segment. Let's go back to the Syria issue. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from today. Pentagon pushes forward on Syria pullout. Military takes steps to withdraw troops amid uncertainty over the timetable for leaving. Now, again, this is an illegal occupation by the United States of Syria. We say this every day. Because it is. I mean, the Syrian government is a sovereign government. It has not invited U.S. troops to occupy parts of its territory. That makes it illegal. The U.N. Security Council has not authorized it. That makes it not legal. The U.S. isn't facing an imminent assault by Syria, which would make it legal as an act of self-defense. It's not legal. But again, we've been discussing, in fact, we've been debating on this show and with some of our different guests, all of whom we have great respect for, about whether or not the U.S. is actually leaving. Trump has been saying since 2016, the U.S. should not be in Syria. He's promised his base, we're going to take the troops out of Syria. He said this publicly, and it caused his defense secretary to resign. Mike Pompeo has since, and even yesterday, reiterated that the U.S. is indeed leaving Syria. Ambassador Peter Ford, the U.K. ambassador to Syria, who's been a guest on our show, says the U.S. is going to leave Syria. Then we have other folks, including some of our esteemed guests, who say, and including people here on this panel, that say, no, the U.S. just doesn't actually leave. It doesn't leave unless it's absolutely forced to leave, say, as what happened in Vietnam when the U.S. was militarily defeated by the National Liberation Front in North Vietnam. Walter Smolarek, your opinion.
I've been pretty skeptical about it since it started. I would definitely lean towards the United States is not leaving position. Although, I mean, with the caveat that Trump is so unpredictable and unlike, I think, pretty much any other president, doesn't care what the sort of elite consensus is on certain issues. So, you know, he certainly has surprised people in the past and he could do it again now, but it seems like there's so much like institutional power arrayed against these moves, right? I mean, there are so many excuses that they could come up with to slow walk the thing or to call it all off altogether. You know, John Bolton laid out those conditions like, well, we can't leave until we're sure that, you know, Iranian influence won't expand in the regions that we depart from. You know, and that could mean any number of things. I mean, that's so vague. You know, he also said, well, you know, we have to be sure that ISIS won't have a resurgence in the areas or and here's another one. Right. So the United States has provided enormous amounts of weaponry to the YPG and their sort of broader umbrella alliance called the Syrian Democratic Forces. So these are, you know, the Kurdish militias. And then, you know, there's the question of, well, you know, the United States needs to get those weapons back, right? And of course, like why would the YPG ever give back those weapons? It would be outrageous. And maybe the United States kind of likes it that way so that they say, oh, well, you know, the Pentagon can go to Trump and be like, look, we're trying to get out. but we're trying to track down all these weapons. You know, we don't want to leave all these weapons in Syria. Or they could do, you know, they might actually depart, but they could depart just over the border to Iraq, where the United States has, you know, significant military presence. I think 5,000 soldiers there. Or they could continue to do special operation raids into Syria, which, you know, like Brian said, would be completely illegal. And, you know, that wouldn't count as boots on the ground because their boots are only on the ground for a really short amount of time. Then they go back to their base. So, yeah, there's lots of ways around it.
Let's turn to another story. And again, we are Sputnik, so we cover the ongoing Russiagate, whatever, however you want to characterize it. I don't know. Trump says it's a witch hunt. We obviously here on our show are Trump opponents, but on this, we might agree with Trump. In fact, do agree. It seems like a witch hunt. There's no evidence yet that shows absolute clarity about collusion. If there is, we'll talk about it. But let's talk about an article from January 8th. That would be a couple days ago. Front page of the New York Times. Manafort accused of sharing Trump polling data with Russian associate. Now, this dominated the news this week. It really did. And here's the New York Times, a picture of Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, convicted last year of 10 felonies. Sounds bad. He's in solitary confinement awaiting his next sentencing. All the charges that he pled guilty to were for financial crimes, not collusion, tax fraud, money laundering, you name it. He was doing lobbying in Ukraine and for the Ukrainian government, by the way, not in support of Russia, but in opposition to what would be perceived by Russia as its interest, because Manafort and company, I think also including perhaps Tony Podesta on the Democratic side, were trying to pull Yanukovych and the Ukrainians towards the West, towards the EU, towards the United States. But here's the article, the first sentences from this article. Again, it shows collusion, right? It's evidence of collusion. Here's the first sentences. As a top official in President Trump's campaign, Paul Manafort shared political polling data with a business associate tied to Russian intelligence, according to a court filing unsealed on Tuesday. The document provided the clearest evidence to date that the Trump campaign may have tried to coordinate with Russians during the 2016 presidential election. Now, read that sentence carefully. It's the clearest evidence to date of what? That Trump may have tried to coordinate. In other words, it's the clearest evidence of nothing, actually. But then there's this. 2 days later, another article from the New York Times, not front page, not big headlines, not many words. Matter of fact, maybe like about 60 words. It's under the headline Corrections, January 10th, 2019. An article on Wednesday about a court filing indicating that Paul Manafort shared polling data with a contact tied to Russian intelligence misidentified the people to whom Mr. Manafort wanted the contact to send the data. Mr. Manafort wanted to send the data to two Ukrainian oligarchs. Okay, meaning that the story isn't true. Now, I looked at the news last night. I don't normally look at the national news, but they were repeating this story last night. Well, after the New York Times correction, again, you could easily miss it because it's only two sentences compared to the original blaring headline. It's not a true story. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, this reminds me of, remember The Guardian, the story in The Guardian about 2 months ago that had the false allegation of I think it was Manafort visiting Assange and how the media ran with that story. And then, a couple of days later, it's just, we know it's not true.
That story said Manafort privately met with Julian Assange three times. That would be another indicator of collusion because WikiLeaks released the DNC emails. Mm-hmm. Just put it all together.
Right.
This is like 9/11 Truth Commission truthers, you know, like putting this little fact together
with
that little fact to come up with the great conspiracy.
And every media outlet ran with it. It was on fire on social media. But then by like 4 days later, crickets, no one saying anything about it because everybody realized at that point, well, it's not true. But the damage had been done. The narrative has been out. And I think it goes to the problems with these kinds of stories and the way the media does this kind of sensationalist reporting goes to the fact that people don't read I mean, people will read the headline and they will share stuff, especially on social media. And they will, you know, and also the MSNBCs and the CNNs, they'll run with this narrative because of the headline. But Brian, in the very first article, like 8 paragraphs down, if you really read the article, you would have known that it was a bunch of nothing then, because it says both Manafort and Rick Gates, the deputy campaign manager, transferred the data to this person in the spring of 2016.
Konstantin Kilimnik.
It goes on to say most of the data was public. So it was out there. So
it was a polling. It was polling data. It was
polling data.
Polling data that the Trump campaign had commissioned.
Right. But some of it, the article says, was developed by a private polling firm working for the campaign. How is this an indication of collusion of anything?
Go ahead, Ted Rall.
You know, another thing that would have tipped me off in that article and did is that word ties. Ties too. I mean, lots of people have ties to lots of people. I mean, I have met in Afghanistan officials of the Taliban, so it would be fair to say that I have ties to the Taliban, but, you know, not in any kind of meaningful way. But lots of people have lots of ties. This is one way in which Brexit has benefited The Guardian, which is based in the UK. In the EU proper, there's actually a rule that states that retracted articles have to appear with the same prominence and size as the original article. So if an article runs on page one of a newspaper above the fold at 4,000 words, it has to be at least as big when it's pulled. It can't be, as The Guardian did, just crickets. And speaking of crickets, if we're going to talk about the way that the media likes to run scurrilous articles with great fanfare and then retract them just like that, just last week on the news that people, listeners to the show, will remember a few years ago when the United States government under the Obama administration accused the Cuban government of attacking U.S. diplomats in the U.S. embassy in Havana with audio attacks. And two scientists reported earlier this week that it appears that the sound that was heard prior to the audio attack, which was recorded by the diplomats, is actually native crickets, which are common in the Caribbean and unbelievably loud.
We thought they might have been trained by Russian intelligence. I think those crickets had ties to Russian intelligence.
And NPR, if you're a regular NPR listener, as unfortunately I am, they have little kickers at the bottom of the half hour, little cute little stories, and they ran the cricket story as a cute little story. That's not how they ran the original allegations, which were given a lot of airtime and treated very seriously.
And used by Trump, these sonic attacks, that's what it was described, causing hearing damage and brain trauma to American diplomats. That was used by Trump as the reason for the U.S. to downgrade its embassy in Havana. About most of the U.S. embassy personnel were taken out. Now, there was reports U.S. embassy personnel were having the same phenomena happen in China. Somehow, in all of these targeted, demonized countries, these crickets are staging sonic attacks against American diplomats. It's uncanny, Walter. It's really, you put it all together, who would have thought it would be Cubans, Chinese crickets, maybe Russian crickets? I don't know.
You know, North Korea is on the receiving end of a lot of these types of stories, too. You know, like, for instance, Kim Jong-un's girlfriend was supposed to have been executed by anti-aircraft batteries, and then her body's fed to dogs. But then, you know, a couple of weeks later, she like shows up at some public event.
That was because Kim Jong-un's wife was jealous that he had an old girlfriend. This, again, a story that comes from South Korean intelligence. Those were coming up like every month. And then all of these dead assassinated people would like make public appearances. So, but again, it's like the retraction or correction in the New York Times. Nobody knows about that part. They only know the initial headline. Again, NPR, since Ted mentioned that he sadly listens to NPR, I do too. I was listening to NPR yesterday after the New York Times correction, retraction of the story. NPR said it categorically as if it was still a true story. Nicole Roussel, our producer, shared with us this morning the Washington Post op-ed today. This is exactly what collusion looks like. This is today. It's a picture of Paul Manafort. The first sentence is, news that President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, provided 2016 presidential campaign polling data to Konstantin Kilimnik, a Russian national with suspected ties to Russian intelligence, starkly contrasts with Trump's repeated claims that there was no collusion with Russia during the campaign. Again, not mentioning today that the basis of the story is not true. What is true is that Manafort is a longtime business associate with Konstantin Kilimnik. Now, the original story said Kilimnik was close to and was given the information by Manafort so that Kilimnik could give the information to a Russian oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, who is said to have close ties with Putin in the Kremlin, right? That's the story. Now, it's not true. What actually we were speculating might be true is that if Manafort was passing information somehow through a liaison to Oleg Deripaska, it might be to try to get back in the good graces of Oleg Deripaska, because guess what? Manafort owed Oleg Deripaska $18 million. And Oleg Deripaska was trying to come to the United States and get a visa. And he said, we thought, well, maybe he was saying, I can't pay you, but I can, because I'm an insider in Washington, I can share political information that will be helpful to you. But in fact, none of it's true. None of it is true. It was going to Ukrainian oligarchs who are now being called pro-Russian. Because I guess if you're Slavic, if you're Ukrainian or Russian, even though Russia is a country that's so big that it spans 11 time zones, anybody Russian is tied to Russian intelligence, and anybody who's Russian is, in fact, close to Vladimir Putin. But let's talk about Oleg Deripaska, for instance, the oligarch who's repeatedly asserted in the U.S. media that he's close to Putin. We did a story about this week. I want to read to you from The Telegraph. It's from 2009. Vladimir Putin takes Oleg Deripaska to task. Subtitle, Vladimir Putin, the Russian prime minister, publicly criticized the most faithful oligarch on Thursday in an attempt to deflect growing social discontent. Well, not really. What actually happened, and here's from the article, this was 10 years ago. Mr. Putin, who is a master at dispensing ritual humiliation, likened Oleg Deripaska to a cockroach and forced him to accompany him on a tour of the city of Pikhlevo, a factory town that has witnessed the most serious social unrest Russia has seen since the start of the global economic crisis. That was, again, 2009. What actually happened? The workers went out because Deripaska, this billionaire, was going to shut down their factory. They went out, they seized the roads, the highways, they created a 250-mile traffic jam. Putin took Deripaska to the town and met with him. And he basically said, look, these workers are being humiliated. They're being deprived of a livelihood. This factory should stay open. And if it doesn't, well, perhaps the Russian state was going to go after Deripaska. So Deripaska came out and said, hey, let's keep this factory open. Okay, that's friendship? Is that the way friends are interacting? He's a businessman. He's an oligarch. He has a relationship. It's obviously a relationship, but not smooth sailing. And yet, no, Americans just don't know any of this, as if anybody who's ever talked to Vladimir Putin is tied to Vladimir Putin.
All of the tendrils, all of the backstory, all of the history, and the actual roles these people that American media outlets keep throwing out in this Russian collusion story, it's just so indicative of how little we know about foreign policy in this country. And it's so indicative of how little we care. I mean, because this one story about Deripaska, I mean, if the president were this country were that angry at, say, Jeff Bezos for, you know, doing the damage that Amazon headquarters has been shown to do in
or Ford, where they're laying off 30,000 workers.
I mean, people. Yes, thank you, Brian. That's actually a better example. Yes, the CEO of Ford has a relationship with Trump. She has ties with Trump. But he's not happy with her, and that's not an endorsement of Trump. But that is an accurate representation of what the tie is. But just because she has ties with him, it doesn't mean that she is in support of him, that if somebody talks to her, she's passing information to Trump, that she's working for him. And it's that level of not just like historical immaturity, but political immaturity in regard to domestic politics and especially foreign politics that is making this Russiagate farce so easy to pull off by the American corporate media in this country.
Ted Rall is another guest. That was Jacqueline Lookman. She's with the Lookman Nation, editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can hear their live stream every week on Facebook, and YouTube. Ted Rawl is an award-winning editorial cartoonist. Go to his site, www.rawl.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. Ted Rawl, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer for 10 years, is going to testify under oath in Congress on February 7th. The circus continues. It's interesting because Michael Cohen finally pled guilty to financial crimes in the Southern District of New York. In other words, not the Mueller probe, because Mueller had been talking to Michael Cohen for a long time. I think he spent 70 hours of interviews and said, we don't have anything left with him, and referred him to the Southern District in New York for criminal referral on other charges not related to Russia. And then a couple of weeks ago, Cohen was brought into court and pled guilty to one charge of having lied to the special prosecutor about whether Donald Trump's attempts to set up a Trump Tower in Moscow, whether those discussions ended in January 2016 or June 2016. It doesn't seem to me to be like that big of a deal. There was no Trump Tower in Moscow. The Russians never gave Trump business permits, something you might do if the guy was a stooge. Nonetheless, the Michael Cohen appearance before Congress, it's going to be a three-ring circus. Go ahead, Ted.
Oh, I mean, as an editorial cartoonist, I live for this kind of thing. It's going to be better than the Kavanaugh hearings. I think the Michael Cohen story is much bigger than the Robert Mueller investigation. And most of all, because we're not going to ever get to see everything that Robert Mueller is getting. He's going to issue a report. That report is going to be in a secure room in the Capitol. And there might be a redacted version issued to the public, maybe not. But the odds are that all the good stuff is only going to be seen by certain select members of the House and Senate, and that's it. Maybe just the Senate. The Michael Cohen blabbing at a House committee hearing is something that we all get to hear, and I think that has far bigger political implications for Donald Trump. Although I'm not exactly sure how it's going to really affect his standing overall. And what I mean by that is, look, there's not a lot of swing voters who are neutral about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not a person who people don't feel very strongly about either way, and that could be swayed by the revelations that are going to come out in next month. So on the other hand, I have to think that Cohen has decided to just completely unload in a way that's only going to prove incredibly embarrassing to the president. Cohen, I think, is really resentful that Trump didn't watch his back after years of loyal service, didn't offer a pardon. And I know that obviously Trump is not in a position to pardon him on non-federal charges such as he might face from the New York prosecutors. But still, he didn't seem to watch his back. Trump has kind of a bad habit of not watching the back of his Confederates. And so I think it's going to be a three-ring circus. The Democrats are going to have a field day. It's going to be something to behold.
Walter, Cohen pled guilty in federal court to 8 criminal counts, including fraud and campaign finance violations directly implicating the president in a crime. Again, not collusion, right? This is from the U.S. Southern District Court. It's not the Mueller probe. You know, there's another story, and this is what Trump and guys like Michael Cohen were doing as Trump's fixer. This is a story back from August 2018, and anybody who lived in New York, and I lived in New York for 30 years, knows that this is all too common the case. Michael Cohen accused of faking documents to flip rent-stabilized apartments. Wonder why rents in New York are expensive? Can't be afforded? Housing Group claims Cohen tried to drive out tenants in order to hike rents and lie to get construction permits. This is what they do. This is what the real estate developers do in New York. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer and fixer, has been accused of filing false documents for 3 New York City apartment buildings, buying the buildings for $10 million, and then flipping them for $27 million. According to an investigation by the Housing Rights Initiative, Cohen and his partners tried to drive out tenants whose rents were kept down by rent stabilization laws so they could hike the rent, the watchdog group said on Monday. Cohen, through a managing agent, filed for construction permits claiming that the buildings were vacant and had no rent-stabilized tenants when, in fact, dozens of such tenants were living there, according to tax records, the housing group said. That's what goes on in New York. Again, the Democrats would do well to expose what these real estate developers and landlords are actually doing to working class and poor and even middle class families with this gouging, this criminal conduct around housing. Again, that's not what they care about, though. They really want to prove that Michael Cohen can take Donald Trump down for anything, but especially Russia or anything, granted. But they're not going to go to the core issue, which is, what did these policies actually do? Because it's not just Michael Cohen and it's not just Donald Trump. This is the way the housing market in New York works. Walter, why don't you speak to that for about 30 seconds? Because Ted Rawl is in New York and knows this very well. I want to get Ted's comments, too.
Sure. Well, I'll just add that, you know, certainly that's a common practice in many, many cities. I mean, the Jared Kushner's family's real estate empire is notorious for doing similar things. In Baltimore, you know, there's a big controversy over, you know, the predatory, unfair housing practices that those corporations were involved in. And so, yeah, I mean, this is what real estate barons do and what rich people do generally.
Ted Rawl, you're in New York.
Yeah, happened to me, happened to friends.
Happened to me, too.
The standard thing to do, I mean, there's lots of different ways to skin a cat, but the rules are basically that if an apartment is rent stabilized or controlled, which means that its rent is set at a certain rate and can only increase by a set percentage as approved by a city board every year or every other year, what will happen is that rent can go to market rate, in other words, soar to many hundreds or even thousands of times more per month, if the landlord can credibly claim or incredibly claim that they did some renovations. And what they often do is they don't do renovations, or they do very small, sort of a Home Depot renovation. They claim that it was much bigger. They have fake letterhead. They claim that they have a fake contractor, when really it's just themselves. They come in, do $1,000 worth of work, say that they did $20,000 worth of work on their fake company letterhead and issue it, and they need a lawyer to sign off on that. And this is not the kind of thing that like one sleazy landlord does now and then. It's standard business in New York City, as you stated, and in a lot of other cities. And you know, rent stabilization is not even that great a deal for the people who have it and don't lose it. So you can imagine what happens when your rent like goes from $2,000 to $4,000 a month. You have to leave, and then that changes neighborhoods.
Last 2 minutes, Santoya Brown's clemency this week, Jackie. That was January 8th, last Tuesday. I'm looking at the NBC News, the article, Santoya Brown's clemency must begin a Me Too movement for unacknowledged sex trafficking survivors. Instead of arresting child trafficking victims, we need to legally treat them as traumatized children in need of services. She had been sentenced to life in prison. She was 16 years old. She was forced into prostitution. She killed somebody who was attempting to do harm to her, but free because of a people's movement.
Yeah, I mean,
really free yet.
That's the key. And as much as I celebrate the fact that Santoya Brown will not have to serve 51 years before she's eligible for parole, the way the corporate media has been reporting this and the way people have been framing the story is that she is just free, that she's pardoned, that Governor Haslam pardoned her. That's not what happened. He granted her clemency, which basically gave her immediate parole. She'll be released from prison
in August,
and she will have to be on parole for 10 years. Now, that's way better than being in prison. Absolutely. That is a victory that wouldn't have happened were it not for grassroots activism. But be clear, Governor Haslam still sees her as a criminal.
Exactly. Yep.
And so does the system, and that's how she will be treated over this 10 years.
And she was arrested as a child. She's been in jail for 15 years. Mm-hmm. 15 years as a child.
Yeah.
A terrible story, but one that has at least a glimmer of hope because people fought back. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been talking with Jacqueline Lookman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We were joined from New York City by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work, and you should, at www.rawl.com. That's RALL.com. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.